Dressed in combat fatigues, at least four gunmen burst into a concert hall in Moscow, firing automatic weapons into crowds, calmly and methodically killing dozens of people. Russian media says the attackers set this massive fire, partially collapsing the roof.
Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. On the 22nd of March, militants attacked a concert hall in a Moscow suburb in an attack that Russian officials now say killed more than 140 people. The Islamic State, or ISIS, claimed responsibility for what seems to be the latest in a string of ISIS attacks in Iran, Turkey, and now Russia. Western officials have blamed the Afghanistan branch of ISIS, its so-called Khorasan province.
Terror in Moscow, the latest attack by ISIS-K, and experts warn probably not the last. ISIS-K emerged in eastern Afghanistan in late 2014 and became known for extreme brutality. It survived even as the so-called Islamic State in Syria and Iraq has largely been defeated. The group doesn't just target the West. It also staged an attack in Pakistan last year and a bombing in Iran earlier this year that killed more than 100 people. Experts fear that ISIS-K is preparing more attacks in several countries.
Despite all the evidence pointing to ISIS, Russian officials, including President Vladimir Putin, have suggested that Ukraine was involved. Here's the Russian president talking just after the attacks.
All four perpetrators of the terrorist act, who shot and killed people, have been detained. They were traveling towards Ukraine, where, according to preliminary data, a window had been prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the state border.
So we're going to do the show today in two parts. A bit later, I'll talk to Olya Olika, our Europe Central Asia director, about what the attacks might mean for Russian politics and for the war in Ukraine. First, though, we're going to talk about ISIS, its Afghanistan branch, and how we should understand the threat they pose. I'm happy to welcome back onto the show Jerome Drevon, who is Crisis Group's expert on Islamist militancy, and Ibrahim Bahis, who's our Afghanistan expert. Jerome, Ibrahim, welcome back on.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
So, Jerome, we heard a bit about this up top, but what do we know about the attacks and the claims of responsibility?
So, four individuals were involved, armed with light weapons, like AK-47s. They started to shoot at civilians, and then they burned down the place. So, according to the official authorities, more than 130 individuals were killed. Very early, the first day of the attack on Friday, there was a claim of responsibility by IS. They were saying that an attack had occurred and that the group was responsible for it. The communique mentioned as well that the four assailants managed to escape, which was not really public information at the time. So the first communique suggests that the four assailants were directly in contact with ISIS. Then the following day, on Saturday, ISIS released a much longer communique in which they again claimed responsibility for the attack. They mentioned additional details and they also showed the pictures that were blurred, but the pictures of the four assailants. Later, the US confirmed publicly that they had no doubt that ISIS was responsible for the attack.
And Jerome, some media reports and some Western officials point at ISIS, the global organization, as responsible, but others, you know, as we heard up top, have looked more closely or accused more specifically the ISIS Afghanistan branch, known as the Khorasan province.
There have been confusions about claims of responsibility. If we look at the past, for example, there were three attacks in Iran, the first claimed by ISIS Khorasan, and the last in January 2024 in the city of Kerman was only claimed by ISIS. But later on, the same cell that perpetrated the attack in Iran also attacked a church in Istanbul and were caught. According to Turkish authorities, the same cell was responsible for both the attack in Turkey and Iran, and it was directly connected to ISIS Khorasan. So it seems there is some overlap in terms of claim, which can simply be a tactic by ISIS for claiming a large-scale operation in the name of the organization, as opposed to in the name of specific provinces.
Could we step back a bit? So over recent years with the US, what focused on China, the war in Ukraine, ISIS and Al-Qaeda linked groups are getting much less attention from Western capitals. In many ways, that's understandable. ISIS has lost the parts of Syria and Iraq that it controlled back in, 2015, 2016. Its original, mostly Iraqi leadership is dead. It simply no longer poses the global threat that it once did. But it does still have these affiliates, these link groups in different parts of the world. We'll talk in more depth in a moment about the Afghanistan branch, but it also has affiliates across parts of Africa in particular. And those local ISIS link groups, in some ways like local Al-Qaeda link groups, they're still destabilizing the areas where they're fighting. So how should we understand ISIS today and the danger that it poses?
So when we look at ISIS now, we think of a network of affiliated groups that mostly share the same idea, the same political project, which is basically to create Islamic states wherever they can, whether this is in Eastern DRC, whether it's in Northern Mozambique or in Nigeria, but that also are in touch with one another. They also often send commanders in different areas to give additional military expertise and advice on specific issues. They also help one another in terms of financial assistance. So, for example, in Africa, the main ISIS group in Somalia coordinates all the financial movement in East and Central Africa. So when we think of ISIS, we really think of that. We think of this network of affiliates with similar ideas and projects, but that in most cases only pursue very local or at best regional objectives. No, for example, ISIS in Nigeria is called ISWA, also targets its regional environment, but nothing beyond, like never targeted the West or the US. So in that sense, the claims about ISK are quite peculiar because this is the only group that's actively focusing on that type of activities.
And Jerome, so what used to be called the ISIS core that emerged in Iraq and Syria, it's sort of mounting local attacks in Syria, but it's very weak. So is there really much direction or the coordination coming from the core in Iraq and Syria?
When we think of the leadership, historically the leadership was only based in Iraq and Syria. It was mostly based on the networks of veterans of the Iraqi war from the mid-2000s. Most of the historical leadership has been decimated. The last three leaders were killed in Syria, mostly based on US intelligence. Some of the important commanders of ISIS based in Syria, who were trying to coordinate some of the affiliates, similarly were killed. And so ISIS named a new leader, but there is no information about him. And while many assume that he's in Syria, Western security sources even doubt that it's possible for a new leader to be in Syria because of the huge US pressure on the group there. So when we think of ISIS in terms of connection between affiliates, it doesn't really have to be based on a key central core leadership, which is very weak if it even, you know, exists in a real form. Most of it happens at a lower level. So, for example, regional commanders, like those commanders in Somalia that try to coordinate some of the financial activities of the group and connect different affiliates to one another without necessarily reporting to the core. So, in effect, when we think of ISIS core, we think of something that's totally different from the core, mostly Iraqi leadership that existed in Syria and Iraq by 2015, 2017.
And Jerome, just quickly before we move to ISKP in Afghanistan and Pakistan, there were former ISIS, particularly women and children, but also like a whole other bunch of detainees held in the camps in northeast Syria, controlled by the mostly Kurdish YPG. I mean, what's happened to those camps? How should we understand sort of what's going on there?
So what we have to see is that there are different types of camps. Some camps, like Al-Hol, mostly are constituted of women, but not only militants. You know, a big part of the individuals living in Al-Hol, which is the most famous, are simply Iraqis or Syrian civilians who escaped the war. In other parts of the camps, we have mostly the foreign fighters. And so those are either the women or the children of former ISIS militants. Many of them of Western nationalities or even from Central Asian countries, Russia, and so on. Some have been repatriated over the years, but many countries, mostly Western countries, still refuse to welcome them back. And so what it seems is that in Al-Houd, for example, ISIS is reorganizing, but around a network of women. So there are female judges, executioners, and so on that try to impose ISIS rules over parts of the camp in terms of dress code, social behavior, and so on. In other camps, there are the men. And so most were fighting with ISIS. Again, they are from different nationalities, either Syrians from a range of Syrian regions, or also Westerners and from other Muslim countries, including Central Asian countries. And there is no clear outlook about the future of these camps. For now, as you mentioned, they are under control of the Kurdish-led SDF forces that still maintain some control. And if the situation escalates, they can receive support by US troops that remain in the region. But there is a very important question mark about the future of these camps. In particular, if the US was to withdraw its troops at some point, what would happen? Would the SDF have to focus potentially on a new war against Turkey, against the regime, and privilege its own survival as opposed to preserving the camps? And could ISIS replenish its ranks by mobilizing once again the people who are in the camps but who could escape if such a scenario was to unfold?
Let's move then to the Islamic State Khorasan province in Afghanistan. And Ibrahim, its roots, from what I understand, trace back to about late 2014, when ISIS was sort of growing, getting to the peak of its global prominence. And in Afghanistan, ISIS, the Afghanistan branch, formed basically from disaffected members of both the Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, and the Afghan Taliban. And that time was a difficult one for the Taliban. Now, its founding leader, Mullah Omar, had died in, 2013. The Taliban had kept that secret. But by late 2014, at least in southern, eastern Afghanistan, the Pakistani tribal areas, rumours about Mullah Omar's death had begun to circulate to surface. And this was sort of raising questions about the Taliban's future, its direction, and that opened space for ISIS.
That's correct, Richard. This was news that the Taliban had not revealed to the world at the time. It was not common in public knowledge. But this news was beginning to trickle within the TTP and the Taliban's ranks by late 2014. And at the time, ISIS was making large inroads in terms of capturing large chunks of Syria and Iraq and building up its global brand. And for many in the TTP and the Taliban who were unhappy with the direction and their status within these two respective groups, this came at a sort of a crossroads, because with Mullah Omar no longer there, whose mystique and position had held it together and made it very difficult for anyone to defect from the group, and now with this new charismatic organization emerging, it created an opportunity for a lot of these local commanders to switch sides. So in late 2014, local TTP commanders and local Taliban commanders banded together and announced the emergence of this new chapter of Islamic State called Islamic State Khorasan Province. Initially, it really very much was comprised of these TTP and Taliban elements, but it did try to make inroads and try to bring more urban Afghans into the fold. One of the things with the Taliban is, because of their very much rural-focused ideology, many urban jihadists inside Afghanistan never really gravitated much towards the Taliban, and ISKP tried to fill that gap by trying to attract many of these urbanized or urban-based jihadists.
And just to be clear, Ibrahim, you're not talking about the old generation of jihadis, as they tend to be called in Afghanistan, that fought the Soviet Union. You're talking about a young, urban, mostly, I think, Salafi pool of recruits that, as you say, didn't find much in common with the Taliban.
That's correct, Richard, and I'm glad you pointed it out, because in our discussion that nuance or the word jihadist takes a different meaning when we're discussing global jihad. But yes, I'm very much talking about those young Islamists. But many of them, because of their urban background, the Taliban's brand and ideology never really appealed to them. So they had always been looking for other groups. And as you said, many of them do tend to be Salafists. But you also have, for example, Muslim Brotherhood-inspired groups and Hizb ut-Tahrir and others who have urbanized in their outlook. And in some ways, that makes the Taliban's ideology very much unappealing to them.
And so you had that one point the Islamic State Khorasan province controlling, you know, a chunk of eastern Afghanistan close to the Pakistan border. This was before the US pulled out of Afghanistan. And you had it recruiting in urban areas and mounting, you know, a series of attacks, often targeting the country's Shia population, the ethnic minority, the Hazaras, and at that time fighting quite a fierce battle with both the Taliban and being bombed by US forces as well.
That's correct. That was a pivotal moment for ISKP because it did control parts of the country and it was fighting a simultaneous kind of battle, not just with the Afghan government of the time and the US and international forces, but also with the Taliban. At that time, it really struggled to maintain and hold on to its territory. But also, I think one of the other struggles it faced was in expanding its appeal. It never really managed to expand beyond the Pashtun belt, where parts of eastern Afghanistan, where it held territory. It did manage to lose almost all territories by late 2020 and early 2021. So before even the Taliban had taken over, ISKP lost territories it controlled inside Afghanistan and began to shift into a new network-based organization, very much resembling what ISIS main or ISIS core looks like today.
And then since the Taliban takeover, ISIS or ISKP has been arguably the biggest security challenge that the Taliban has faced. No? People will probably remember this terrible attack on Kabul airport during the evacuation as people left after the former government fell and the Taliban took Kabul. But what, over the past year or so, the Taliban does appear to have weakened ISKP considerably. I mean, despite a lot of attention on ISKP from Western officials and counterterrorism experts, which we'll come to, in Afghanistan at least, ISKP is weaker than it was a few years ago. Is that right?
ISKP really has struggled to maintain a foothold and expand within Afghanistan since the Taliban have taken over. If we look at the data in terms of ISKP attacks, it really has begun to decline. When the Taliban initially took over, ISKP tried to mount a comeback starting in September 2021. It tried to launch an urban-based insurgency against the Taliban in Nangarhar province, but the Taliban responded to that by flooding Nangarhar and really heavy-handed tactics against Salafist communities. Over time, the Taliban have begun to adopt more nuanced security mechanisms. For example, there are reports of Taliban infiltrating ISKP networks within the country and using that to gather intelligence. And as you pointed out, ISKP has lost many of its top commanders over the past year and a half. But during this period, we've kind of seen a bit of a change in ISKP's approach. After it failed in its urban-based insurgency in late 2021, one of its main strategies has been to criticized the Taliban's diplomatic outreach to regional powers, including China, Russia, and others. So starting in early 2022, it began to target foreigners inside Afghanistan, including, for example, a suicide attack on the Russian embassy in September 2022, and also attacks against the Pakistani embassy and a Chinese-run hotel in December of the same year. Prior to these attacks, in 2022, ISKP also launched a couple of cross-border rocket attacks against both Uzbekistan and Tajikistan. These were some of the first instances where ISKP kind of claimed attacks outside of its own self-defined Khorasan province. Other foreign plots claimed by ISKP was also the October 2022 attack in Iran on a Shia mausoleum. In August 2023, ISIS once again targeted the same mausoleum. This time, however, ISKP didn't claim the attack, even though Iranian officials named a Tajik national, Rahmatullah Nuruzov, as the person responsible and said that Nuruzov had spent 3 months in a training camp inside Afghanistan and was in contact with ISIS networks in Turkey through the internet. ISIS Central or ISIS Core has claimed the January Kerman attack in Iran without specifying which particular province or branch of the group was responsible. Even at that time, Iranian officials also identified one of the bombers as a Tajik national and said that he had received training in Afghanistan's Badakhshan province. As Jerome pointed out, when a smaller attack in Turkey's Santa Maria Church occurred early this year, Turkey officials linked this attack to the same unit that was responsible for the attack in Iran. So I think an inference can be made that ISKP is linked with these networks. But on the flip side, whether these attacks are being planned in Afghanistan's eastern mountains, or whether we are seeing ISIS as a global organization metamorphosizing, and you're seeing more symbiosis between ISKP, the organization that very much recruits locally and has a mainly local focus, as well as its more global networks, its Central Asian, North Caucasian networks that were historically more connected with ISIS core, but now seem to be more and more communicating and interacting with ISKP.
So what you describe, Ibrahim, in some ways, and we can get into how much this matters when we talk about the sort of threat it poses, but in some ways it's a bit misleading to describe it as either the ISIS core, if we understand the ISIS core to be sort of the remnants of the group that held Iraq and Syria nearly a decade ago, or ISKP, if you think of ISKP as an insurgent force in eastern Afghanistan. What you're talking about, and you know, I guess this organizational structure has been quite common to ISIS or Al-Qaeda-linked militants in the past too. What you're talking about really are networks, as you say, mostly in this case of Tajiks or other Central Asians, maybe people from the North Caucasus that might have some connections to ISKP. Maybe they're trained in Afghanistan, or alternatively, or at the same time, they might have some connections in some cases to Syria, where a lot of people from those regions fought with ISIS.
My impression really is that because ISKP core, ISIS core, has lost its territorial control, so for many of these networks that you mentioned, these Russian-speaking Central Asian, Caucasian, or North Caucasian networks, Afghanistan or ISIS-K becomes one of the few options. Even though ISKP is struggling against the Taliban, it doesn't have territorial control. But because Afghanistan is such a prohibitive land, and because of history and the fact that ISKP still has extensive covert networks inside the country, it makes it appealing, I would argue, for these networks that when they want to receive practical training, that they come into Afghanistan to receive that training and then before going to carry out attacks. But then, conversely, I would also argue that ISKP really has redefined back to its self-defined province, very much focused on Afghanistan. Let's look at this recent Moscow attack. ISKP came out and actually praised the attack without claiming responsibility, but then tried to frame it as some kind of an anti-Taliban narrative, saying like, why are the Taliban condemning the attack in Moscow and they don't condemn Russia's actions in Syria?
If I may add, I agree with Ibrahim's point. I think there is something that we have to look at ISK differently from the way we look at other affiliates. Like if we look at, for example, ISWAP in Nigeria or ISIS in the Sahel, we think of traditional, quote-unquote, insurgents that somehow control territory, have a clear chain of command. In the case of ISK, I think it's a hybrid group. So it's both an insurgency within Afghanistan that is fighting the Taliban, but combined with a network of militants that's linked to them, but that organize different types of operation mostly abroad. So those militants have been involved, as we mentioned earlier, in Turkey, in Iran, now in Moscow, and other places that are trying in Europe. And it seems that in terms of the foreign operations, there is really a prevailing role of these Russian-speaking and Central Asian minorities, some of whom have been involved in the war in Syria. Many died there. At the time, if we remember, they were the head of the Tajikistan Special Forces that joined ISIS in Syria. So many died and perished, but others managed to escape to Turkey and then went further and beyond Turkey.
And Jerome, the US, as you said, had issued public warnings for US citizens in Moscow ahead of the attacks. US also apparently warned Russia that an ISIS attack could be imminent ahead of the last attack in Iran in January this year. Also apparently warned Iran of the attack. So the US seems to have pretty good intelligence, at least on ISIS. How do Western officials see the threat from ISIS now? And how is it different from the threat that ISIS posed in its heyday and when it controlled this big chunk of territory in Iraq and Syria?
So when we speak to Western officials, They look at ISIS affiliates in general, but for them, most of the ISIS affiliates, particularly in the Sahel, in Nigeria, in DRC, in Mozambique, are fighting for local objectives. For them, it's not an immediate threat. When Western officials speak about IS, they really speak about ISK. A US general mentioned that ISK could potentially project people in Western Europe and stage attack there. At the time, he said within 6 months. And Western officials really believe that ISK is the main threat for them. At the same time, it's a very different threat from the past. If we look at plots that were aborted by Western security services, but also based on our discussions with security officials, there are two types of recruits in Western countries, in Europe in particular. First are increasingly young recruits, even from 14 to 20 years old, that are motivated by the burning of the Quran in Sweden, by more identity issue in a way, and that are influenced by ISK through social media. And then they try to launch their own attacks, but it's very unsophisticated, often with knives and things like this.
We should say that the majority of those attacks are stopped, right, by the security forces, by Western security forces.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the large majority is aborted, and those that are successful don't result in many victims. So these are the first type. The second one are more individuals from Central Asian communities. Sometimes were involved in militancy in the past, in Syria, for example, but not necessarily. They often don't speak as much the language, they're not as integrated, so they don't have the right connections to gather weapons or to gather the right information and to basically plan sophisticated attacks. And what Western sources mention is that those two publics, they don't really mix with one another. And that's one of the critical differences. In like 2015-16, ISIS controlled very large parts of Syria and Iraq, so it could attract thousands of foreigners. And so it could select them, it could train them, it could test them in Syria to see if they were really reliable and then send them back. And those people were coming from European neighborhoods, from Paris suburbs, from Brussels, and so on. And so for them, it was much easier to plan large-scale attacks because they knew their environment, which is very different from what we see now.
And yet, there has been now this string of attacks. So this attack in Moscow that killed more than 100 people, an attack in Iran a few months ago that killed also scores of people, I think nearly 100. Several plots, as you say, have been disrupted in Western Europe. I think the German Interior Ministry has sort of issued explicit warnings about ISKP. Reportedly, the French worried about ISIS attacks around the Paris Olympics this summer. Now, of course, we always have to be careful not to inflate the threat, but the Moscow attack and the attack in eastern Iran, these are not the work of alienated kids or sort of atomized migrants. These seem much more the work of networks and people with experience and training.
Yes, definitely. And that shows that IS is evolving and is adapting also to the situation. When we think of this group, we think of an interconnected network of militants, and that part of these militants also have experience in the past, have received training, and are acting as such. Hence why they've been more efficient in some of these countries, like particularly in Iran and Russia.
And Jerome, ISIS has always fought on all fronts, even when it controlled territory in Iraq and Syria back in the day. I mean, it was never discerning about picking its enemies. It struck a variety of different states. So in some ways, it's a bit misleading to ask sort of whether it has specific reasons to target any one country like Russia. But it does have sort of particular beefs, particular grievances with some countries, obviously the West, many attacks in Western Europe. Iran, too, ISIS is a deeply sectarian, deeply anti-Shia. Iran has fought ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And Russia, maybe you could argue the same, that the particular grievances relate to what Russia's role in the North Caucasus, its support for the regime in Syria, its support for Iran, or it's just more sort of traditional Islamist resistance to the Russian state?
So there are two main types of reasons for ISIS to attack Russia. First are historical reasons. The memories of the war in Afghanistan in the 80s are still vivid for many groups. Then Russia fought two wars in Chechnya. More recently, Russia was heavily involved in the Syrian conflict. So even though Russia mostly targeted other insurgents, those that were not aligned with ISIS. Russia also attacked ISIS, particularly in some areas, you know, like the city of Palmyra was basically seized by the regime thanks to Russian assistance. And that's also one of the reasons at the time why another ISIS affiliate, ISIS in the Sinai, attacked a Russian plane in October 2015. More recently, in addition, Russia has noted new ties with the military juntas in the Sahel to fight local insurgents, some of whom are aligned with Al-Qaeda, but some of whom are also linked to ISIS.
And so, Ibrahim, the Taliban, you said earlier, have been attacked by ISKP for trying to build relations. The Taliban have been seeking international recognition. They want closer relations with particularly their neighbors. And you know, Russia, Iran, Turkey, which has also been attacked, these countries, none of them are formally recognizing the Taliban government, but all of them have been engaging the Taliban on issues related to the economy, but also issues related to counterterrorism, trying to push the Taliban to, you know, curb threats that are emanating from Afghanistan, of which now ISKP is probably seen as one of the greatest. So what do you think this spate of attacks and the Moscow attack in particular, what do you think this is going to do for the Taliban's foreign relations?
The ISKP threat is one of the primary reasons why regional countries have continued to try to engage with the Taliban and build relations with them rather than kind of isolating them. They see security threats emanating from Afghanistan and impacting them. And they argue that in order to address those, they need to be engaged with the Taliban. And ISKP, again, remains one of the primary kind of security threats for most of the region, not the entire region, but countries like Russia, Central Asia, Iran.
Right, because for Pakistan, it's the Pakistani Taliban, the TTP, which I guess we should say is posing now a real challenge to Pakistan since the Taliban took over in Afghanistan, this uptick of violence in Pakistan. And I guess for China, Uyghur militancy still more of a concern, even though Uyghur groups in Afghanistan are pretty small.
That's correct, yes. But for most of the remaining region, ISKP tends to be the primary kind of threat that they see. But you mentioned earlier, which was an interesting tidbit, that the US had 2 weeks before this attack had warned its citizens to avoid large gatherings inside Moscow and reportedly had warned Moscow of an imminent ISIS attack and had similarly warned Tehran of the an imminent attack before the January Kerman attack. But what you hear often from the regional capitals is not really this narrative. It's often quite the opposite. For example, the Russian foreign ministry spokesperson said that ISIS is attacking anti-American countries like Iran and Russia and Afghanistan, implying that somehow the US is supporting ISIS's activities in the region. And this is something not peculiar to Russia alone. Iranian officials have come out several times and said America is secretly assisting ISIS or ISKP and it's a common thread.
Though we shouldn't take those allegations too seriously. No, I mean, regional powers have histories of both accusing rivals of backing militants and sometimes playing double games themselves.
You're absolutely right. But where the problem I think it creates is it tends to hinder the cooperation between Western intelligence and regional powers. And I think arguably one could make the argument this could also impact and hinder intelligence cooperation between the Taliban and the US. After the Doha agreement, there was intelligence cooperation between the Taliban and the US in combating ISKP. But with this new narrative with the region, there is a fear that this could start to impact if the Taliban begin to suspect that, you know, the US is somehow involved in the activities of ISKP. I think arguably it could impact the cooperation. That would be a huge loss. But I think what we've seen so far is that there is actually a level of cooperation between the Taliban as well as the region and even the US, even if publicly they seem to be accusing each other of all sorts of things when it comes to ISKP. I say this because, as I mentioned earlier, when the Taliban first took over, they really didn't know how to combat ISKP and went really heavy-handedly targeting and alienating large communities in Afghanistan, including the Salafist communities and sometimes ethnic minorities. But over the years, they've really began to carry out more targeted operations. And some suspect that these have been enabled because Western intelligence and regional intelligence have been able to share information with the Taliban, pointing where they need to go and carry out attacks. With the attacks in Iran, Iranian media and at times officials have come out publicly and said that the Taliban are helping them catch and target some of these ISKP cells who have been operating in the country. So the regional cooperation vis-a-vis or against ISKP seems to be building up, probably a bit slow, as we've seen with these larger and larger attacks that ISIS is carrying out. But this rhetoric of blaming each other and trying to deflect the problem rather than recognizing that it needs a coordinated approach, I think, is one of the biggest hindrances when it comes to where to from here and how do we combat this growing threat.
Ibrahim, Jerome, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Richard.
So we're going to turn then to the second part of the show, and I'm delighted to welcome back on Olya Oliga, who listeners will know is Crisis Group's Europe Central Asia Director. Olya, welcome back on.
Glad to be back.
So let's talk a little bit then about what the implications might be for the war in Ukraine and for Russia itself. So although, as we talked about, ISIS claimed the attacks, the US have warned that ISIS was planning an attack beforehand. I mean, it has the hallmarks of an ISIS attack. There is this sense from the things Putin has said and the things other senior Russian officials have said that they want to portray Ukraine as responsible. What do you make of that?
Look, this is speculative in terms of what to make of it. I think to some extent, this is in the same genre as the Russian talk about Ukrainian plans to develop a dirty bomb. I think it's testing the waters to see how well this will play with different audiences, what kind of a response it can get. It's also very much part and parcel of a general Russian policy view of itself against a US-led West. So anything bad that happens has to come from the West. Though, you know, at the same time, the Russian foreign ministry's spokeswoman did complain that the Ukrainians weren't being sufficiently sympathetic to the Russians. So there's a lot going on and it's not always entirely consistent. But I do think that from a policy standpoint, it's an effort to put everything into kind of the same frame that Russia is in a battle against the West and that it's an existential battle and that the West will stop at nothing. So I think that's part of the narrative. In terms of the US warnings, you know, what that made me think of first and foremost was 2013 and the Boston Marathon bombing in the United States, when Russian authorities had warned the United States that something was going on. And what the United States later said, very similarly to what the Russians are saying now, is there wasn't enough information to really do anything. Now, Russian authorities do say that they did foil an attack a couple of weeks ago against a synagogue. So it's also possible that they were investigating and they caught some of it and missed this one. Look, I'm firmly of the belief that the Russian security services are able to walk and chew gum at the same time and focus on different things. But from a political standpoint, you could certainly make the argument that Russia has been focusing on the wrong threats, though that's certainly not what we're hearing these days in Moscow.
And Olya, I want to come in a moment to the domestic implications, the implications for President Putin himself. But to what extent do you think Russian citizens buy the idea that somehow Ukraine had a hand in it?
Well, look, if you watch the first channel and listen to what they say and believe it, then you're absolutely going to believe that it's the nefarious Ukrainians possibly put up to it by the even more nefarious Americans. If you have access to a variety of sources, you are not going to think that. You know, I haven't seen any polling to see, you know, what people think. I think we're going to have to see how it plays out. The other piece of this that's really important to watch is to the extent to which it translates into prejudice against and further securitization of people of Central Asian background and Central Asian ethnicity in Russia and perhaps elsewhere. But I also think it's very possible for Russians to blame Central Asians, blame Ukrainians, blame Americans all at the same time if that's what the easy answer they're being offered is.
What do you think the implications for the Ukraine war might be? Some people have said that it might be used as a pretext by the Kremlin for another mobilization drive. Others have sort of ruled that out. Other people have said it may be used as a pretext for different tactics in Ukraine, assassinations, that sort of thing. What do you make of those ideas?
Look, as far as we know, there have been efforts to assassinate Ukrainian officials already. So I don't know that this changes anything particularly in terms of bombarding Ukraine or launching attacks into Ukraine. Again, this is going on now. There's been pretty substantial bombing campaigns over the last week into Ukraine by Russia. If we're talking about larger scale offensives in Ukraine, then Russia might need to put together more people to do it. And, you know, then there's this question of whether this is a justification for mobilization. Again, it's right. It's a tenuous connection. There's no evidence. And I do want to underline, there's absolutely no evidence of any kind of Ukrainian involvement in this. And nor would we expect there to be. But they have a lot of excuses that they've created to attack Ukraine. Most of them, perhaps all of them, not particularly grounded in any kind of reality. So I'm not sure this changes the dynamic that much. Mobilization, maybe, for their mobilization, does it kind of make the population more nervous and more willing to accept? But when I talk to Russians, they tell me that the people who are going to protest mobilization have already left. So the ones that are still in Russia are going to go along with it if it happens. The Kremlin doesn't seem to think so, or they would have moved faster to mobilize in previous months. So.
And so the Russians arrested, as, you know, as we heard, the four Tajiks that perpetrated the attacks, some others that they allege are accomplices. And the four Tajiks were, you know, one of them had had his ear cut off. The other one was obviously had been, you know, badly beaten. Videos were circulated, seemingly deliberately, of Russian security forces torturing the suspects. I mean, you know, on the one hand, you know, the Russian state, particularly under President Putin, hasn't been shy about its brutality. But this does seem another level, and clearly sort of something that's deliberately designed to intimidate. How much should we sort of see this as a symbol of the dark turn that Russia has taken over the last couple of years?
I mean, absolutely, right? It is a symbol that there is an acceptance of this sort of horrific violence, of disregard for any kind of standards of human decency in treating suspects. It's, it's toxic masculinity on steroids, right? It's just, it's horrific, and it is very emblematic of what we've seen kind of more gradually in Russia, but, you know, we've seen it with videos put out by Wagner. And I think the message is to anybody that, you know, this is what you're in for if you go against the state. I think it's really important to understand that the perpetrators of this attack, the alleged perpetrators of this attack, they're going to be tried at least partly for terrorism. But terrorism is also what various human rights groups, political opponents are charged with in Russia. So if the Russians say this is what we do to terrorists, you have to remember this terrorism is a word with a very broad definition in the Russian Federation these days.
And there's some talk about bringing back the death penalty in Russia.
So we've had, there are members of the Russian parliament who called for that. There's some question about whether that means that they have changed the constitution. But if you lifted the moratorium on the death penalty specifically for terrorism, you've just said that the death penalty is also potentially going to be applied to human rights activists and people who just simply oppose the government.
And I realize it's very hard to get a sense of this at the moment. But I mean, are the political implications for Russia? Obviously, this is a major security lapse and the sort of thing that usually a leader might get blamed for. People frustrated that this was allowed to happen. On the other hand, Putin has used things like this in the past as opportunities to either entrench himself or pursue more aggressive tactics in other places. How do you see this playing out in Russia's domestic politics?
I think there, I've almost no doubt in my mind that this tragedy will be used to justify further crackdowns. I don't see this as, you know, presaging any kind of opening, right? I don't even see how that would happen. I think, you know, you can point to any number of things as cracks in the edifice of an all-powerful Russia. And of course, Russia is not all-powerful. But these don't mean that Russia is on the verge of imminent collapse. I think, you know, if you write the history after the fact and you're looking for examples of things that showed that Russia wasn't entirely stable, yes, obviously. But if you're looking for some kind of a causal story that this is going to be the straw that broke the camel's back, the camel seems to be doing okay.
Olya, thanks so much for coming on.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Hold Your Fire is a production of the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. You can check out all our work on the Islamic State, on ISIS, across the world, and on Russian politics, on the Ukraine war, on our website, crisisgroup.org. Look out for our Q&A that we put out this week on the Moscow attack. Thanks to our producers, Gibbon Murphy, Heiko Schaub. Thanks, as ever, to all of you, our listeners. Please do, as usual, get in touch if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns. podcast@crisisgroup.org, or write to me directly at crisisgroup.org. If you like the show, please do say something nice about us. Leave us a 5-star review. We're going to take a break next week, but we'll be back the week after that. So please do join us next time.